Genesis is, of course, the first book in the canon of Scripture, in the list of books in the Old Testament. That doesn't mean it was written down first. Remember, we've been learning that throughout the weeks. The books were often passed on, especially in the Old Testament, by word of mouth, and then later on written down. And we'll look a little bit at that later on. But I want to go right to the end of the chapter, of the right end, the last chapter of the book, chapter 50, reading from verse 22. Joseph stayed in Egypt along with all his father's family. He lived 110 years and saw the third generation of Ephraim's children. Also the children of Machir, son of Manasseh, were placed at birth on Joseph's knees. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I'm about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear on oath and said, "God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up from this place." So Joseph died at the age of 110, and after they embalmed him, he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. That's the last verses of Genesis. And it's the whole book speaks about beginnings and origins. In fact, the word Genesis means that in its original meaning, the beginnings and origins. The beginnings and origins of humanity, of all of us, and yet also the beginnings of Israel and their history. And as I say, we started at the end of chapter 50, where we hear about the death of Joseph. And he says, the last command is, "Take my dead bones home. Don't leave them here." Which is a message to them that, you know, this part of our journey is going to be here in Egypt. But that's not where the story ends. It might be this chapter, but the whole book is a bigger story than just us as a tribe within the people of Israel, where we're a displaced people and we're going to be going back home. So don't be burying me too deeply. Get ready to take my bones home again. And later on in Exodus, you read about that, they do take the bones of Joseph with them back to Israel. So I'm going to go through the book in a slightly different way to start with. So Joseph's the end of the story of Genesis. Joseph is the son of Jacob, that's right. So the story of Jacob, and then Jacob has a brother called Esau. And Esau and Jacob are the sons of Isaac. Jennifer's top of the class so far. And then before Isaac, of course, he's the only son of Abraham, that's right. Abram, originally known as. And really, that takes you from chapter 12 the whole way through to 50. So a big chunk of the book of Genesis is about the earliest family, the patriarchs as they're called, the earliest family in the beginnings of the people called Israel. So if you like, it's their way of saying, you know, who are we? Why are we who we are? Why do we live in this place? Why? It's the little child's question. Why? 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 And the answer is it goes back to this family, Abram, the original one, his son Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. And before the story of the family, chapter 11 is about the Tower of Babel, at a point where, if you like, humanity is moving away from itself in different directions. And chapter 6 through to 9 is about the story of Noah and the flood. And before that, all sorts of stories about the generations of people between the original family, Adam and Eve. And of course, chapter 3 is about the fall. Chapter 1 and 2, two different creation accounts. So starting the end and working your way back, that's what's in Genesis. That's a kind of an overview. We've talked a number of times about the importance of the exile when in around about 590 BC, they were put out of the land into Babylon. And we've a number of the books we've looked at already have been to do with both the run-up to that, what happened during it, and what happened after it. It was a seismic moment, even more than the Exodus, I would say, in their nation's history and their identity. While they were there, for the first time, they encounter a significant literary culture. They passed on stories by word of mouth, oral tradition, we call it, from one generation to the next. They did it accurately in a way that we wouldn't believe, but they wouldn't believe about things like emails and text. So we find it struggle to remember shopping lists. My wife says to me, "Will you get such and such when you're at the shop?" And it's gone by the time I've got out the door. So she often says to me, "What did I say to you?" I say, "I'm not one of your children. What did I say to you? I've forgotten. Sorry." We've got terrible memories. We don't remember. We don't retain stuff. Because with an internet world, you can find out any information on a second, on the watch, on a phone, on an iPad, on a computer. You can find out what you know. Knowing how to find information is the skill now, not retaining it. And that's changed in a generation. I mean, I can remember going to school in the 1970s when, you know, we were still doing times tables and we were still learning our spellings. Now you just need to know how to look up someone, a calculator, and or a spelling of a word on an online dictionary. We don't need those skills so much now. So knowing how to access information is more important now. But way before our generation, way, way back, 2,000, 3,000 years ago, things being passed on by word of mouth, so much more important. So it was Babylon, meeting this literary culture where things are written down and stories are told and preserved, they thought maybe we should preserve our story just in case we never get back to the land again of Israel. And so they, at that point, gathered together the different stories that they'd passed on and the different bits and fragments of writing that they did have. They did have some written stuff. And they brought together the five books that we now call the Torah or the Pentateuch: Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And that's the first time that those five come together as the written authoritative scriptures and recording of their origins and their life together. And, you know, just a little bit deeper on that, those who study in depth the first five books of the Bible would say that you can actually discern four different voices. They call them J, E, D, and P for brevity's sake. But there's one author that you can sort of see a literary style that constantly refers to God as Yahweh, and that's called the J source. And then there's another source that seems to always call God Elohim, or just God, and that's the Elohist source. And then there's another one, the P, the priestly tradition, D, the Deuteronomist, the one who's largely behind Deuteronomy, but you can see smatterings of his stuff through the rest of the books as well. So the idea is that the first five books of the Bible are actually an amalgamation of different sources from different parts of the country, because they couldn't just jump on the phone and tell each other. I might tell the story in my village, you tell the story in your village, and over time they get shaped with the concerns of each village. But when they come together, that you can see and discern the four different voices. That's why you can be reading the same passage and it seems to say the same thing twice. Why have you said it twice? You might find something as simple as the name Yahweh being found in one place and the word Elohim being used in the other. And it just shows that there's two different sources behind there. You don't need to know about that too much, other than just it's interesting to know that the books we now have in our hands came through a long period of refinement and a journey to get to where they are today, which is fascinating in itself. But it was important for them during the exile to capture their story and to write Genesis down about their origins at that stage. partly because it was important for a generation that wasn't in the land and wasn't at the temple and wasn't getting told the stories of the faith in the same way they had when they were in the land. It was such a part of their life. It was so important for them to retain those stories. Every year I run the candidate support group in the region with other colleagues in the area. And one of the days we have is called the Methodist Rooting Day, which is basically helping them to get to know their own roots. Most of our people just don't know their own story as Methodists. You know, we don't actually know our own story sometimes, our own history. And we spend a day with them, just introducing them to the main things of our history, of our story, of our theology, of our way of being church, because we don't know it. Actually, it's part of our DNA to say that we don't know it. This sounds really Irish, but it's a perfectly Methodist thing to say that I'm a Christian first and a Methodist second. We say that with pride, but actually that's a very Methodist way of understanding faith, which sounds very Irish, but that is part of our DNA, that we don't actually hold that strongly to our story, and yet we quote Wesley and John and Charles at left, right and centre and refer to historical precedents from them and from the 19th century as well in all kinds of ways. So getting to know our story was a big part of why Genesis came about in the first place. Let's just look at a few passages. Genesis chapter 1 is to do with creation, of course, and it's that passage where it says, "In the beginning, God." In the beginning, God. And that really is where it starts. In the beginning, God made the heaven and the earth. It then gives the creation in six phases or days, yoms as it is in the Hebrew word, which could be a 24-hour period or it could be a longer period. There's another verse there in the Bible that says a day is like 1,000 years in the eyes of God. So, you know, we're talking about periods of time. I don't know about you, but I've heard the sermons, I've been to the seminars, I've read the books that bend over backwards to try and make alignment between scientific facts about what we know about the origins of the earth and the Bible accounts of Genesis 1 and 2. And we bend over backwards trying to bring the scientific world and the Bible world together. I decided a long time ago, and you can argue with me if you like, but Genesis chapter 1 was never written down trying to answer the question, how? That's the scientific question. That's the science they want to argue. So we put ourselves up into this battle, creation versus evolution and all this sort of stuff. But actually it's a waste of time because the Bible was never written with those questions in mind. The question behind the Bible was who? And what for? And why? Not how. And so the scientist tries to answer the question how, the theologian, the Jewish or Christian theologian, who's behind Genesis 1 is trying to answer the question who? Who's behind it all? Why is it? So I think those arguments about, well, you can fit in a six-day creation into an evolutionary pattern are just a waste of time, really. That wasn't written for that purpose. It is poetry at the end of the day. It is metaphorical language trying to answer a question about our origins. And the point of Genesis 1 is life has a beginning. All of life has a beginning, and it's in God. He's the origin of all things. It's one of the core convictions, if you like, or profound theologies of the Bible, that life has its beginning and continuance and belongs ultimately to God. And one of the words it uses in Genesis chapter 1 is, of course, that God made it and it was good. It was good. Actually, the Hebrew word is tov. Think of the word tooth and take one of the O's out. So tov, the word tov. And it literally means good. It means it has purpose, it has meaning, it has value, it has a destiny, it has all those things, it has design, it has purpose. All those words lie behind this idea of tov. And so it's an important message, not just in the Bible in chapter 1 of Genesis, but in every generation, that every single human life and every single part of human life and of creation has purpose and value and worth. It's good. It's made by God. And so even where you see the most broken and evil human life, even there, the starting point is not they're evil. The starting point is that they're made in the image of God and they're good and they have value and they have worth. And if only we can reconcile them with their Creator, then we might see something of what He made them for. We're made in God's image. That means we're made to be relational to God. We're made to relate to God in a way that no one else does in the whole of creation. And there's a calling. The whole idea of vocation starts right in Genesis chapter 1, that we're called into a relationship with God that starts from the beginning and continues throughout. Genesis chapter 2 is a second creation story, and this time it's more centered on humanity, the story of Adam and then Eve. Genesis chapter 3, of course, is trying to answer the question, why do things go wrong? And why is there suffering? And why do we fall out with each other? And why do people war against each other? Why has the world got so many problems in it? Why is there suffering? And the answer is down to the story of the Garden of Eden, where there's this perfect fellowship with God. But God enters something into the garden that puts choice into place. People need to choose whether they're going to follow Him and make Him first and allow Him to be God or not, right from the beginning. And for the earliest stage, they do choose. They choose to walk with God each day in the cool of the evening, as the beautiful idyllic picture of Genesis 3 gives it. But soon enters in our desire to be in control, our desire to be to have personal autonomy. I call the shots. I'll be in charge. Right from the start, there's this desire to fear and to run away from vulnerability. If God's in charge, then I'm not in charge, and that feels a bit vulnerable. He might do something that I don't like. So is the fear of vulnerability. And yes, there's self-centeredness, and yes, there's selfishness. And you can look at every human deed where there's suffering over 2,000, 3,000 years, and again, it comes down to those basic human issues of control and of willfulness and of personal autonomy, selfishness, self-centeredness, and the fear of being vulnerable and needing to get control. And yes, I've said it before, I'm quite happy to go public on it. I think that there's something happening in our nation right now in the whole moving away from Europe and looking at a different way of existing in the future. That is, we must try and get control. We must be in control. We've got our sovereignty. That goes right back to the Garden of Eden, that desire for control. But when we cut God out of the picture, it ends in tears. And there's some beautiful pictures in there. I mean, the walking with God in the cool of the evening is just a beautiful picture of walking with God. There's also this beautiful picture of Adam and Eve having recognized that they're naked, having eaten the fruit. They tried to hide from God. I always think that's funny. You know, God comes looking for them. Gosh, I've misplaced Adam and Eve. And the God who sees everybody and everything all the time in all the universe, where on earth have I placed Adam and Eve? We've got a problem here. Where have they gone? When God asks the question, Adam, where are you? It's not because God's lost Adam. He needs Adam to know where he is. So where are you? Well, I'm hiding behind a bush and I've got a pair of wife ropes made out of fig leaves and this is completely stupid that I would try to hide from God. It's a beautiful picture. The other thing that enters in that Genesis story is right from the beginning, when we start making the wrong choices and we realize that shame and guilt leads to blaming of others. Adam, where are you? Wasn't me, it was her. You know, it's that woman you gave me. Everything was fine before you gave me that woman. You know, and that's where the breakdown starts, right from there. Blaming of others. And a them and us mentality as well. Not our fault, their fault. The world's such a problem because of them. Not taking responsibility. for myself. And if I might be controversial for a moment, we often and sometimes want to blame Satan or the devil or the demonic hordes of hell for all the problems in the world. I want to say, yes, I don't deny the existence of such entities, but I want to take a lot more responsibility for us as human beings and our ability to mess up and to say, actually, hands up, I messed up. Most difficult words in the English language to say, I'm sorry. Most difficult words in the human language to say, I got it wrong. And yet that's what we're invited to do right from the start. Adam, where are you? I'm hiding from you because I blew it. So there's right from the beginning that important chapter 3 that says something about human nature and human reality. The flood, yeah, the flood's about lots of things. The flood's about God's justice, which is spelled out by Paul in Romans chapter 1, 2, and 3, where he says, you know, God's justice and judgment is really about God saying, okay, if you want to do your own thing, if you want to make your own choices, I'll allow you to do that. And when you do that, it'll end in tears. It'll end in a mess. And it ends in a mess with people being out of relationship with each other, breakdowns in relations with one another, seen ultimately in Cain and Abel, the first pair of children in the family, as it were. And it happens in Noah's generation, and it happens and has an impact environmentally, the flood, etc. So there's all kinds of themes in that those chapters 6 to 9 about the consequences of making our own choices and walking away from God. Chapter 12, as we said before, sees the beginning of the story of Abram. I'm going to bless you, and you will be a blessing. God chooses from all the people of the earth one family, one man, Abram. And while the Methodists don't use this language very much, it is about election. God choosing this one to be assigned to bless in order that he might be assigned to everyone, knowing that they might be blessed and that they might be blessed through him. And that's important because we often read the story of the election of Abram and say, gosh, God's blessing is on him and we're the children of Abram, God's blessing is on us. But he is blessed in order to be a blessing. I.e. he's meant to be a drain pipe, not a water butt. A water butt collects water and, you know, it just gets fuller and fuller until it overflows, but it's about containment. We're not meant to be containers of blessing. We're meant to be drain pipes through which the blessing of God is both received and given out. There's a pattern there right from the start that informs our discipleship even today. Now, I want to just take a real big jump. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff about the nature of God, the names of God, God's activity with Abram, the whole story of Abram offering Isaac up as a sacrifice, all that stuff. There's lots of stuff in there. But I want to jump right ahead to the story of Jacob and his shenanigans. Now, Jacob, if you remember, he's a twin, and he grabs the heel of his brother Esau as he's coming out of the womb. And the name, you know, he's a grabber. He's a struggler right from the beginning. He's a wrestler right from the beginning. And life never goes easy for poor old Jacob. Him and his brother have a major bust up, and his mother sends him off to Uncle Laban. Out in the wilds of the countryside, many, many, many miles away, so he's safe from Esau. But while he's there, he works for Laban, and he falls in love with his daughter, Rachel, and says, basically, you know, fancy her. And Laban says, well, you can have her if you work for me for 7 years. And after 7 years, comes to the wedding night. Laban's thinking, gosh, I'm going to lose this lad, so let's get him really drunk and marry him to the wrong daughter. So he marries Leah instead of Rebecca. He must be pretty drunk, Rachel. And sure enough, he wakes up next morning and says, good morning. Ah! and realizes he's married the wrong woman. And Laban says, well, if you really want the other one, then you're going to have to work another 7 years. So he works another 7 years and he gets her. But can you imagine what it feels like to be Leah? I mean, what is Laban playing at? Setting up the actions of Laban, these, the small thing of, you know, let's see what this veil looks like on you, Leah, instead of Rachel. But let's just realize that action and that decision of Laban has massive implications for the whole of faith history. Because, you know, there's the setup of the poor relationships between Leah and Rachel and Jacob. And it just gets worse and worse. So let me read some stuff for you from chapter 29. I think this is dynamite. I don't know, I hope none of you watch Jeremy Kyle, because it's awful television. You can get these families that are pulled out of, you know, some of the most chaotic communities and lifestyles in the country, and they're just made spectacles of. But you really could put Jacob and the family in the Jeremy Kyle show. So let me just read to you. And remember, God says, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So he marries Leah, Jacob's children, verse 31 of chapter 29. When the Lord saw that Leah was not loved, so he's married to her, but she's not loved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So he's sleeping with both of them, even though he's not in love with Leah. But, you know, he'll still pay a visit, as they say. Leah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Reuben. And the name Reuben means misery. Hello, son, misery. and she says, surely my husband will love me now. I've given him a boy. She conceived again. So, you know, he's still enjoying himself there. Even though he doesn't love her. And when she gave birth to a son, she said, because the Lord heard that I am not loved, he gave me this one too. So she named him Simeon, from which you get the name Shema, which is to listen, and the name Samuel, all linked together. So Simeon. Again, she conceived. When she gave birth to a son, she said, now at last my husband will become attached to me. Three sons. It takes a bit of time to have three children, if you remember the biology. And all this time not feeling loved, and he's still sleeping with both women. Because I have borne him three sons. So she named him Levi, this idea of attachment. She conceived again, fourth child. And she gave birth to a son. This time, I will praise the Lord. So she named him Judah. Right? Judah means praise. Then she stopped having children. Now, when Rachel saw, chapter 30, verse 1, when Rachel saw that she was not bearing Jacob any children, doesn't say they weren't trying, she became jealous of her sister. Toxic relationships in his family. So she said to Jacob, give me children or I will die. No pressure, Jacob, you know, give me children or I'll die. No pressure. Jacob became angry with her and said, am I in the place of God who has kept you from having children? So, you know, it's a really toxic mixture. So then, gets better. She says, here is Bilhah, my maidservant. Sleep with her, because she belongs to me, and through her, I too will have children. So basically, Bilhah, the slave, you know, she's doing the dusting or whatever. Come here, man, in the bedroom with him. So she gave him her servant, Bilhah, as a wife. Jacob slept with her, taking one for the team. And she became pregnant and bore him a son. Then Rachel said, not Bilhah, Rachel said, God has vindicated me. So she calls the son Dan. Rachel's servant Bilhah conceived again. Not one go, but two. And she gives him a second son. Rachel said, I've had a great struggle with my sister, so I'll call him Naphtali. All these names are significant because of the breakdown in the relationships. I mean, Reuben's walking around, he's still called Misery. He's having great fun being the eldest son, Misery. When Leah saw that she had stopped having children, she took her maidservant and called Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife too. You know, coming home at night time, which of the four? Which of the four? You know, I think one's enough trouble, but the four. Leah's servant Zilpah bore a son, and she says, what good fortune. She calls him Gad. She bore a second son, and she calls him Asher, which means happy. And then you see how toxic this household is. During wheat harvest, Reuben went out into the fields and found some mandrake plants, which he brought to his mother Leah. Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. But she said to her, wasn't it enough that you took my husband? Will you take my son's mandrakes too? It's a bit toxic in this house, isn't it? You see it, Jeremy Kyle having a good go with each other. Very well, Rachel said. He can sleep with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes. Good Lord, you know, coming home at night time. You know, quite fancy a bit of that, lasagna you've got there in the dish. Can I have some of that lasagna? Well, only if you let me sleep with your husband. Okay, fine. Great. So when Jacob came in from the fields that evening, you know, he's beaten up by a day's work. Leah went out to meet him. You're coming with me tonight. I have hired you with my son's mandrakes. Okay. So he slept with her that night. God listened to Leah, and she became pregnant and bore him a fifth son. And Leah said, God has rewarded me for giving my maidservant to my husband. So she named him Issachar. Leah conceived again, and Jacob bore a sixth son. Then Leah said, God has presented with a precious gift, and bore him six sons. She named him Zebulun. Sometime later, she gave birth to a daughter named Dinah. Another one, just Dinah, girl, never mind about her. Then God remembered Rachel. Oh yeah, of course, remember Rachel, the one he really wanted to marry in the first place. He listened to her and opened her womb. She became pregnant at long last. This is the first one she's had. And she gave birth to a son. God has taken away my disgrace. She named him Joseph. Yeah? Hence why he's the father's favourite. And she added, may the Lord give me another son. Later on, she does have another son. His name's Benjamin. The two favourites of the daddy, the son that he has from Rachel, and so Jacob. What a toxic mix of relationships. How would you like to live in that household? My goodness. 13 kids, one girl who gets raped in the next chapter, and the boys go and sort that out. And eventually Jacob flees and goes back into the promised land, reconnects and gets reconnected with his brother Esau, but keeps showing his son Jacob the bit of extra, you know, support and a bit of extra spoiling. And there's nothing like a spoiled child to create a bit of tension in the house, you know. Yeah, no matter how much you try to treat your children the same, there's always one of them says, well, you like her better. And there's always the one of the children says, you like that one better. They always feel that. So what happens? What happens then? Well, Joseph with his many coloured coat, or actually that's how it's translated in the King James Version. The original Hebrew word means long sleeves. Long sleeves is to do with the fact that it's quite a big coat that really would cover you well. The rest of them might have had shorter sleeves, which weren't as opulent or weren't as special, but he's got this garment he walks around in day to night. Big symbol that he loves him more than the rest of us. And what's worse is he's got a gift. A gift for both having inspired dreams and for sharing them in the most inappropriate way. Let's face it, if God gives you a dream that you're going to be king of the crop in this family, you're not going to go out next morning at breakfast, well, what did you dream about last night? Well, I dreamt I was going to be in charge of all you lot. So he's gifted, but he's immature in the use of his gift. often happens in church life and in community life. God gives somebody a gift and then they're immature in how they use it. So it ends in tears. Joseph ends up in a pit, left for dead. It's actually Reuben, the eldest son, who tries to save him. But then they see this caravan of slave traders going past and say that's the way to take care of him. Send him down to Egypt, thinking he's dead now, literally. But go back and tell Jacob the lie. He's dead. Found his coat, look, oh, blood on it. Well, in Egypt, what does Joseph do? He tries to remain faithful to God. He becomes the servant of Potiphar. And in Potiphar's house, he tries to be the most faithful person he can be. It's as if he's doing it unto God, and he raises up the ranks there. God shows him favor. And then there's a troublesome woman, Potiphar's wife, who takes a fancy to him. But he says, I won't do anything here. It's going to blow my relationship with my boss or with my God by just going for the easy lie. So she takes umbrage, and he ends up in prison. But again in prison, he's faithful. And he gets the notice of the warder, and you know, he looks after the rest of the prisoners, and he's there for a long time. All the time, he's got this dream that says he's going to be in charge. All this time, he's got this sense of a connection with God. All the time, he's got this hope that this isn't the end of the story. And every day, the key of the door opens, and they bring him his food. And he thinks, is it food today, or is it release? And I reckon there's something like 18 years where he's in prison here. And then there's one day, there's a beautiful verse around with chapter 45. In one day, he gets the call from the king. He's cleaned up and he's brought into the presence of the king, and life changes in one day as he gives the interpretation to the dream. It's a wonderful picture of salvation, that called by the king, cleaned up and brought into the presence of the king. It's a wonderful little cameo of the gospel. Of course, and the story doesn't end. You've got the brothers coming down looking for food, and there's this wonderful drama where he eventually lines them all up and reveals who he is to them. And they're thinking, gosh, we're in trouble now. But they're not in trouble. And he says, you meant it for harm. Right at the end of the book, back in chapter 50, you meant it for harm, but God meant it for good. The thing about Genesis for me is, in the midst of this chaotic family, a toxic family, this chaos, God is still happy to be known as the God of Jacob. And he's still happy to work in that chaos and through that chaos to bring those people during a time of famine into Egypt. And ultimately, that's not the end of the story. When the bones get collected after his death, we're going back someday. And that's not the end of the story. And if I might just finish on this, next Friday we'll feel the weight of the death of Christ. But in the words of the old Tony Campolo book, it's Friday, but Sunday's coming. And even Sunday's not the end of the story, because there's Ascension and then there's Pentecost. And as we said back in the very first session of this series, in the book of Acts has still been written. The end of the story isn't the end of the story until he returns. And even then, it's only the beginning of a whole new story. So Genesis. Genesis, the story of our origins, was wonderful truths for its core convictions that are still of use to us right down to today. Okay.